This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org.
Good evening, and welcome to Readings and Conversations, sponsored by the Lannans, and with Amy Goodman and Tim Flannery. I'm Leanne Vredenberg. I'm Executive Director of the Friends of the Bosque del Apache National Wildlife Refuge. As you were coming in, I hope that you had an opportunity to view the slides and to see some of the amazing wildlife, the beautiful vistas, as well as some of the programs and projects that we have going on down at the refuge. I also hope that you've had a chance to take that Sunday drive or that weekend getaway to come down and experience the Bosque firsthand. It is truly one of New Mexico's greatest natural resources. It's wintering ground to sandhill cranes, tens of thousands of snow geese, but it's also an important migratory stop for hundreds of thousands of other birds throughout the year, and that's just the tip of the iceberg. The Friends of the Bosque was formed in the early 90s to support the educational and outreach objectives of the refuge. Since that time, we've grown, whether it's sales from our nature store, which have now brought us to the level of being one of the premier nature stores in the National Wildlife Refuge System, or it's our membership, which is now 1,000 members strong, or it's donations and grants, until a point where now we can provide formidable and sometimes necessary funding to the refuge. During the last 3 years, because of budget cuts, the Bosque del Apache National Wildlife Refuge has lost 3 staff positions. During that same time, the Friends of the Bosque has contributed over $750,000 to Bosque del Apache programs, and the volunteers have constituted a $1.3 million workforce. But we don't just benefit the refuge, we also benefit the local community and greater New Mexico. Each year, 3,000 New Mexico school students come to the refuge and go on tours. And each year, the Friends of the Bosque give $3,000 in travel stipends to these schools, without which many of them would not be able to visit. We also have a dedicated watershed educator who works with the underserved and underfunded schools in Socorro County. She teaches the children to learn geology through poetry. She teaches the water cycle through painting. And she teaches them to hear the voice of the Rio Grande and to understand it in their own way and its future as well as ours. And then to accommodate all of these students, in 2005 and 2006, we constructed an educational and meeting annex to the Bosque Refuge Visitor Center. We've also recently bought property for incorporation into the refuge's wilderness area, and we're currently working on getting congressional support for an appropriation to reinstate those staff positions and to provide much-needed upgrades for the refuge. If you are interested in any more information about the Friends, about becoming a member or our educational program, or our Festival of the Cranes, which will be in November, please see our table out in the foyer after the show. And without further ado, I'm pleased to begin the program by introducing Amy Goodman.
Thank you, Leanne, and it's wonderful to be here. Though these are very difficult times, very important that Tim Flannery joins us when we think about what is happening around the country, from California, the fires, to the drought in the Southeast. Just a few of today's headlines to talk about why it is so significant to discuss the issue of climate change. Yes, we have the fires continuing to rage in Southern California, engulfing hundreds of square miles, forcing close to 1 million people to evacuate. More than 1,000 buildings have been destroyed so far. Today's forecast calling for higher winds. Meanwhile, a top California official has criticized President Bush's visit to California and called on him to order the California National Guard in Iraq to come back home to help California. And then you have the Bush administration being accused of severely editing the congressional testimony by a senior health official on the impact of climate change. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention Director Julie Gerberding appeared before the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee on Tuesday. The Associated Press reports two sources familiar with both her initial draft and the White House's revisions say the administration imposed major changes. Gerberding's final testimony is said to have omitted lengthy passages she had initially included on the health risks of global warming. Her final document was whittled down to 4 pages from an initial 14. An anonymous CDC official said the White House eviscerated the testimony. The White House had no comment. Democratic senators are calling for the release of Gerberding's full, unedited statement. As if that is not enough, the censorship comes days after President Bush's top science advisor said increased global warming has no effect on natural disasters. White House Office of Science and Technology Policy Director John Marburger was explaining his dismissal of the widely shared target of preventing the Earth's temperature from rising more than 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit. He said, quote, "The goal is going to be a very difficult one to achieve and is not actually linked to regional events that affect people's lives." Tell that to the people who are fleeing the fires in Southern California. Tell that to the people of Tennessee, the Carolinas, and Georgia that are undergoing what could be their worst drought in history. Is it possible Atlanta will run out of water? And speaking of water, what about the drenching rainfall in New Orleans, as if the people of New Orleans can stand another natural disaster? Which is why it's so important tonight to listen carefully to Tim Flannery. You know, we live in a globalized world, yet we are so insulated in this country when it comes to getting information, like Tim Flannery has been writing about, speaking about for decades in Australia and here in other parts of the United States. Tim Flannery. His books, his work, his research. He is a paleontologist, a mammalogist, has discovered 70 species of marsupials, rodents, bats. His work is remarkable. He calls himself an environmental historian. In 1980, he discovered dinosaur fossils. Just this year, he was awarded one of the highest honors in Australia. He became Australian of the Year. Given that honor by the Prime Minister of Australia, John Howard, which I think there's some poetic justice in. Here is Tim Flannery taking on the fossil fuel industry, condemning the use of, well, coal burning. And here is the Prime Minister, who represents really everything Tim Flannery is speaking against, giving him the award and saying, "Tim Flannery has introduced us to new ways of thinking." The history of Tim Flannery's books, I think, explains very much who he is. Beginning in 1994 with The Future Eaters, an ecological history of the Australasian lands and people. And then in 1998, Throw 'Em Way Leg, Tree Kangaroos, Possums, and Penis Gourds on the Track of Unknown Mammals in Wildest New Guinea. Then there's the explorers, stories of discovery and adventure from the Australian frontier. The eternal frontier, an ecological history of North America and its peoples. Chasing kangaroos, a continent, a scientist, and a search for the world's most extraordinary creature. And finally, the weather makers, how man is changing the climate and what it means for life on Earth. An urgent warning and a call to arms. A book that documents Tim Flannery going from global warming skeptic to one of the most important global warming scientists, explaining, not just in lay terms, but what is so powerful about Tim Flannery is his magnificent writing, as he really documents where we have come from, the dire state we are in, but ultimately, how hopeful he is what is so instructive. Tim Flannery believes we can come out of this mess. I'll end with David Suzuki, the award-winning scientist who says about this book, The Weathermakers, "This is one of the most important books of this young century. Flannery leads us through the remarkable scientific elucidation of the factors shaping climate, the sun, atmosphere, oceans, and life itself. The scientific evidence of humanity's impact is indisputable, and this book convincingly pierces the phony economic, political, and pseudoscientific naysaying. It's an urgent call to action that we cannot afford to ignore." It is wonderful to see all of you coming out tonight. I only wish in the front row that the Bush administration, the cabinet members, that they were occupying these seats. Tim Flannery has something to teach them, all of us, tonight.
Look, thank you so much for that wonderful welcome, and thanks for being here this evening. And particular thanks from me to the Lannan Foundation for bringing me here. You know, your city of Santa Fe has an almost sort of magical aura about it in the imagination of Australians. I've always wanted to come here and see this wonderful part of the world, and I've had an opportunity to do that today, which has been just wonderful. I've also discovered here a community of people who really does deeply care about the land that supports you, about your country. And that's something that's very precious to me and very precious to everyone in this 21st century of ours. What I'd like to do this evening is just talk about this big issue of climate change. I must admit, when I woke up this morning and it was such a lovely sunny day at a time when it probably should be a bit cooler here, I started to worry a little bit about giving this talk because I thought maybe some of you people might think that climate change is not such a bad thing after all. But it's worthwhile remembering that climate change is a trajectory. It's not a state of affairs, it's a trajectory of change. And while this year we might enjoy a lovely Indian summer, 5 years from now those same conditions may have worsened to the point where water becomes a critical issue for you. So we can't afford to be failed by the weather. We're dealing with a much bigger issue here than just a lovely warm Indian summer. Although, please enjoy it. Don't let my talk in any way mar your enjoyment of this wonderful weather. You know, when I've been in the US now about 10 days, and when I arrived, Al Gore had just received his Nobel Peace Prize, which I think is the greatest tribute that any human being can receive. To me, it is the great award. And I'm not an American, but I was so proud of him just as a fellow human being to be honoured in that way. And yet, within a few days of my arriving, I saw the newspapers were full of this sort of sniping at this great man and wondered about it and thought it's not... It doesn't do the skeptics any any great justice. I think it's just disturbing that someone who has done so much for the world could be treated in that way. But in any case, one of the people who was having a bit of a shot at Al Gore was a man called Dr. William Gray. And he spoke at the University of North Carolina within just a couple of days of me speaking. And one of the things that he said to his audience was that he said the human impact on the atmosphere is just too small to have a major effect on global temperatures. And those sort of assertions really need to be tackled and explained, because so many people just accept that from a professor as a given and accept it as a credible sort of statement. So tonight I'd really like to just have you reflect upon that statement a little bit as I talk and try to explain to you the way the atmosphere works, the nature of this problem, and what is actually happening to our world right now. A really useful starting point in trying to think about the whole climate problem is just to conceptualise it as a pollution problem. After all, these greenhouse gases are pollutants in our atmosphere. Even the US Supreme Court earlier in this year ruled that the principal greenhouse gas, carbon dioxide, should be considered as a pollutant. It's a very, very important step in terms of our dealing with this issue, incidentally. But I like to think about the climate problem as a pollution problem for a particular reason, and that is that us humans, I reckon, have become really, really good at dealing with pollution problems. I worked for many, many years in remote parts of Papua New Guinea and the Pacific Islands and stayed in villages that were well outside government control. And those villages might only have had half a dozen grass huts, and the people who lived in them may still have been living a Stone Age type of existence. But those villages were kept immaculately clean, because people just know that if you let rubbish build up around your village, your health will be compromised, and eventually it'll be to your great detriment. Now, the first villages, the first human settlements that remained in one place were established around 10,000 years ago in the Middle East. And I think that we can look at the role of natural selection acting on our species for the last 10,000 years as being a real weeding out of the grubby among us, you know, because presumably when we settled down in those first villages, there was quite a few grubby people who didn't care about throwing their pollution around, and a few who did. And evolution favoured those who did. Now, those of you who have teenage kids may not believe me in this, but I really do think that evolution's done a great job of making us a neat and tidy species by and large that has a really gut feeling, has an important and strong gut feeling about pollution. We just know in our hearts it's wrong to allow our environment to become full of filth. There's been times in our history when it's looked as if maybe filth would overwhelm us because population has grown and industrial process has changed. One of the times that I can think of that makes that point was Europe, and particularly London in the early 19th century. Now, that was the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. It was a time when London was the largest city on our planet. And that city of a million or so people was entirely unsewered. I mean, I can't imagine what a city of a million people would be like without a sewage system, but, you know, there are written accounts of what it was like, and some people record walking down the street and looking in cellars and finding that the cellars of the houses were ceiling high in you-know-what. I won't ruin your dinners, but it was pretty gruesome. And as a result of those, that the build-up of that waste, human health was compromised in London. Cholera, for example, was just an endemic disease. It was around all the time. At that stage of medical development, people believed that cholera was spread through the air. And it was a great surprise when a doctor did a proper epidemiological study in London and revealed the astonishing news that cholera, in fact, was spread through dirty water, specifically through sewerage getting in to water that people drink. And this was an enormous challenge to the people of the day. The doctors, of course, didn't like it because they didn't like being proved to be wrong. And neither did the wealthy citizens of London, because that knowledge carried with it an important implication. Of course, it was the poor people of London who were getting cholera. They were the ones forced to drink the filthy water. The rich, the wealthy, could bring their water in from elsewhere. But who was going to pay for the sewering of London, cleaning up the city? It wasn't the poor. It was those relatively few wealthy citizens. And the issue was debated back and forth for a couple of decades, really, as to what should be done. Finally, the decision was made to embark upon that gargantuan project of Sura in that city. No one had done anything like that before, except maybe the Romans well before, but certainly no one within living memory. And when you read the accounts of what it was like to embark upon that project, it was rather like us, I think, thinking about sending a man to the moon in the middle of the last century. It was a great enterprise. It was going to cost a lot. And it's really interested me to try to understand why people decided to do it. After all, it was going to be to their financial detriment. It was a massive project with uncertain long-term outcomes. But people did it. And the reason I think, after reading extensively around that subject, the reason I think it was done was just that people felt it was the right thing to do. You know, there's a certain sense in our hearts about what is right and wrong, and people at that stage felt it was the right thing to do, and so the project was begun. Mind you, I can't imagine what London would be like today if they decided that it wasn't all that important. New York would have been the global centre of capital. I don't know. Anyway, it's an aside. But it does give me hope to think about this pollution problem we face as a pollution problem. Of course, climate change is a very special kind of pollution problem. It's an air pollution problem. And in order to understand why that's so important, we need to know something about this atmosphere of ours. The atmosphere, I think, has to be the most taken-for-granted element of our planet. Just the very name, the atmosphere, you know, my old aunt used to come and visit us occasionally, and one of her favourite sayings was, oh, you could have cut the atmosphere with a knife, you know. She's talking about the atmosphere between two people, or we talk about the atmosphere in a room, you know, or the atmosphere of the planet. Just the use of that word for anything from the smallest amount of air through to the whole planet's worth reveals something about our disregard for this organ of our planet. And yet what a wonderful and wondrous and necessary thing it is. I mean, from the moment that some anonymous doctor picked us up by the heels and whacked us on the bum to get us to take our first gulp from this great aerial ocean of ours, to the moment we breathe our last, we are plugged into it and connected with it in a way that we're not connected to any other part of our planet. It is the great interconnector of all living things. It connects us with the oceans. It connects us with the rocks beneath our feet. It's the great moderator, the great interconnector, the great enabler of life on this planet. In the 19th century, you know, when people were discovering the wonders of the atmosphere, one of my great heroes came up with a better name, I think, for it, and I've already used the name. The man was Alfred Russel Wallace, co-founder of the theory of evolution with Charles Darwin. And he described this atmosphere of ours as the great aerial ocean. And I love that phrase, because when I think of the atmosphere as an aerial ocean, I can imagine the currents in it that bring us our weather. And I can think of myself as a sort of an insignificant creature crawling around on the bottom of the great aerial ocean, as totally dependent upon it as any fish is on the sea. It's also important to me because it really invites a very important comparison. When we look into the heavens, we think that, or we can imagine, the atmosphere just goes on forever, and it doesn't really matter what we throw into it. A bit, as Dr. William Gray said, human impact's just too small. In order to understand why that's wrong, we've got to carry out a bit of a thought experiment and imagine, if we could, compressing all of the gases in this great aerial ocean 1,000 times until they become a liquid. We'd need to do that because air is about 1,000 times less dense than water. If you could carry out that thought experiment and then imagine comparing the oceans with the great aerial ocean, what you'd discover is that this atmosphere of ours is only 1/500th the size of the oceans. 1/500th. And that explains so much to me of recent environmental history. You know, us humans, we've always believed there's an away that we can throw stuff to. And so, you know, until recently, when I say recently, last few decades, the city of New York used to just barge its rubbish out into the Atlantic Ocean and dump it overboard. So many cities around the world still just drain their sewage straight into the oceans. And the Russians, God bless their cotton socks, you know, they've been busy secretly throwing whole nuclear reactors into the ocean, not telling anyone about it. I mean, you know, so, but for all of that abuse that the oceans have received at our hands, we haven't suffered a global oceanic pollution crisis. Why is that? Just because the oceans are so big. The difference between polluting the oceans and the atmosphere is a bit like having a house with a leaky septic tank, you know, in one case running into a tiny creek, and the other case into a mighty river. It doesn't matter if it's running into the mighty river. If it's running into a little creek, it can have a huge impact. Over my lifetime, I'm 51 years old, the history of atmospheric air pollution has been dismal. I've lived through three, as have many of the people in this audience, three separate and distinct global or near global air pollution problems. The first of those problems, which will probably be familiar to people here, became known as the acid rain problem. I don't know whether you remember it here, but in the 1970s, people were disturbed to find great tracts of forests and lakes and soils across the Northern Hemisphere dying. And the reason wasn't immediately evident. It turned out that the cause was the burning of fossil fuels, particularly coal, with a high sulfur content. And that sulfur would go up into the atmosphere with the flue gas when you burnt the coal, combine with moisture in the atmosphere and fall to the earth as sulfuric acid, where it would scald the life out of anything that it contacted. If I could just take a little sidetrack here, so I don't want to bore you, but why was sulfur in the coal? Well, there's a lot of complex reasons for that, but one point I want to make is that coal is a sponge. Anything that's mobile that flows through the Earth's crust tends to accumulate in coal. So cadmium, mercury, uranium, you'll find lots of it in coal. You know, one of the reasons people here maybe, or I'm not sure whether this is an Australian problem or not, but women are generally recommended not to eat too much fish while they're pregnant because it's full of mercury. That mercury comes from the burning of coal, the great majority of it. How it gets into the fish is a long story. I haven't got time to go through here, but it comes from the coal. In my country of Australia, where there's lots of uranium in the coal, the biggest point sources of emissions for radiation are coal-fired power plants. They're not the world's biggest uranium mines, which we have in our country. It's coal-fired power plants. And lung cancer rates around those power plants are a third higher generally than elsewhere in the country. Just to get back to the acid rain problem. Once people realised what was going on, they brought in regulations to make those coal-fired power plants put scrubbers on the smokestacks of the plants. And a very ingenious man, a man called Richard Sandor, who established the Chicago Climate Exchange, came up with the idea of trading in pollutants. And that might sound counterintuitive to a lot of people in the audience, but we can't change things overnight. So the idea of licensing someone to pollute but charging them is a very powerful incentive to change. And it's also great in terms of making sure you get the best bang for your buck, if you want, when you're dealing with these pollutants, because the person who can most cost-effectively afford to reduce their pollutants can sell their credits to other people. As a result of those sort of moves, within a couple of years, really, the acid rain problem was a receding threat. You know, sulfur only lasts a couple of hours, or if the air is very dry, a couple of days in the atmosphere. And so once the sulfur stopped being emitted, Earth could heal itself. I should just say that fact, the short time span of sulfur in the atmosphere prevented the problem from being a truly global one. That's why I call it a near global pollution problem. But the wondrous thing is, you know, once we stopped putting that sulfur into the atmosphere, Earth started to heal itself. And I just think we just don't give enough credit for the astonishing capacity of this home of ours to heal itself when it's severely damaged. We just seem to accept it as normal. I think it's a miracle, quite frankly, and a wondrous miracle that allows us to maintain ourselves on this planet. And it's something we need to know so much more about as we move into this century of ours where we're going to be putting ever more pressure on this environment of ours. Within a few years of that acid rain problem being addressed, scientists told the world of a very disturbing finding. British and American teams in the Antarctic had started to measure the level of ozone in the atmosphere over the Antarctic, and had independently measured or recorded great drops in ozone concentrations over the Antarctic. The drops were so great that the individual teams initially thought that their instruments must have been in error. And it was only after a couple of years of recordings that they compared their data and realised that this was actually a real trend. Why were they so disturbed and so surprised? Ozone is a very rare element in our atmosphere. It's only present at about 6 parts per million, and most of it's 50 miles above our head. But it does a very important job for us because ozone is Earth's sunscreen. You know, if you brought the whole of Earth's sunscreen down to sea level and you could see it, it would form a layer about that thick, about 3 millimetres thick. There's just not a lot of it. But without it, we would be in serious problems. In Australia, where I come from, if I go out in the summer without a hat and without sunscreen, I'll generally get a fairly bad case of sunburn in around 20 minutes. I don't know what it's like here, but I imagine similar sort of figures. Without ozone, I'd get that same level of sunburn in about 15 seconds. So you can imagine how important that is. I mean, ultraviolet radiation that causes sunburn is a very powerful short wavelength of energy, and it penetrates our bodies, it tears apart our DNA, it disturbs metabolic processes within the cell, and therefore it leads to cancer, and it can also lead to blindness. It's just high levels of ultraviolet radiation are incompatible with light. That's why, you know, you see in barbershops those blue lights where people try to sterilise their combs. That's kind of like ultraviolet radiation, sort of, you know, not very good for small living things. So as scientists started to see this ozone depletion, they became quite concerned. At that stage, no one really knew what was causing the problem. And it took a couple of Nobel laureates, a couple of brilliant Americans who won the Nobel Prize for Chemistry, to track down the cause. And what they discovered was that a chemical that was only manufactured by people, that didn't occur in nature, was causing this depletion. They discovered that what are called chlorofluorocarbons, or CFCs, were at the root cause. Now, these CFCs were used for things like blowing up styrofoam cups and for propellants in spray cans and for refrigerants and so forth. And they were, you know, initially the last thing you'd suspect of causing any problems, because they're totally stable at sea level. They just don't seem to interact with anything, so how could they be causing a problem? What scientists had failed to understand was that as these CFCs rise up through the atmosphere, after about 5 years from being released from your little spray can, they'll get up to a elevation of 50 miles above our head, and there they break down, and those chlorine atoms in those molecules can destroy many, many thousands of ozone molecules. A single chlorine atom can destroy many thousands of ozone molecules. The reason that, of course, the ozone was depleting over the Antarctic was that that chemical reaction is most effective at very low temperatures. That discovery had such a profound impact on people that it galvanised the world to get together and agree to ban those chemicals. And the protocol under which they were banned was known as the Montreal Protocol, an agreement reached in Montreal, Canada, in 1987. And that moment is a moment in our human history that I think we fail to celebrate significantly. I know we've had some great things happen, like a Martin Luther King Day in this country. I think we need a Montreal Protocol Day to celebrate our escape from a dreadful peril, quite frankly, because we now know what could have happened. If we'd failed to agree as a species on banning those chemicals in 1987, we know what the trajectory of chemical production was. We can work out what the burden of the greenhouse gas, the CFCs would have been as of 2007, and we know what that would have meant for our Earth. And what it would have meant was that today we would have had a permanent ozone hole over the Antarctic rather than just a seasonal one, a second permanent hole over the Arctic, and very severe ozone depletion down to middle latitudes. And that would have added up to a greatly enhanced rate of cancers in human beings, a greatly enhanced rate of blindness, and very severe crop failures, because seeds are small little things, small rapidly growing things whose DNA is vulnerable. For every 1% decline in ozone, 1% increase in radiation, we get a 1% increase in failure for seeds to germinate. The same thing happens at the surface of the ocean, where these tiny creatures are the basis of the food chain. So if we hadn't agreed in 87 to ban those chemicals, I think we would have been facing a full-blown crisis of life on Earth. And I just one more aside, sorry, because I find this so wonderful. If chemists in 1928 had decided to make bromofluorocarbons instead of chlorofluorocarbons, I don't think we'd be here today. The reason they didn't use bromine instead of chlorine was that bromine was a little bit expensive back then, just a tiny bit more than chlorine. And it was... It had a couple of characteristics and made it a little bit less favourable for the particular applications that they had imagined for these chemicals. But the big thing about bromine is that it's 46 times more effective at destroying ozone than chlorine. So we would have just had no ozone layer and wouldn't have known what had gone wrong, would have happened before we'd really even come to grips with the problem. So 87, we had the Montreal Protocol. The following year, there was a series of heat waves in this country, and Congress called on for testimony from a number of scientists to explain to them why these heat waves were occurring. One of the men who testified that year was James Hansen, the director of the Goddard Institute at NASA, and he was a man who really woke the world, I think, to the perils of yet a third global atmospheric pollution crisis. What he said was that a build-up of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere was trapping heats close to the surface of our planet and was consistent with the sort of phenomenon that we were seeing in those heat waves in 88. I need to explain just briefly to you what greenhouse gases are. There's about 30 of them. They let sunlight reach the surface of our Earth, but when that sunlight turns to heat energy, they tend to trap that heat energy close to the surface of our planet, and so the planet starts to warm up. If there were no greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, of course, there'd be no life on Earth. They're a natural part of our planetary system. Without greenhouse gases, the surface of Earth would be at a temperature of about minus 15 degrees. It'd be a snowball. We couldn't live here. But if greenhouse gases ever reach 1% concentration in our atmosphere, the surface of our Earth would boil. So it's one of the miracles of our planet that greenhouse gas concentrations have been kept within a range compatible with life. Look at Mars and Venus and you'll see atmospheres with greenhouse concentrations 90% plus. Dead planets have lots of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. Living planets keep them within strict bounds. And could I just say in that regard, it really is important to understand that this atmosphere of ours, not only is it small, it's out of balance with the geosphere. It's out of balance with the rocks of Earth. Dead planets have atmospheres which are totally concordant with their geology. They reflect their geology. Our atmosphere reflects the presence of life. And you can think of the atmosphere as not as a living thing, really, but as a manifestation of life. It's a manifestation of life every bit as much as a cat's whisker is or a bird's feather. It's created by life, sculpted by life, kept in this particular balance of gases by life itself. The most important of the greenhouse gases is carbon dioxide, and it's measured in the atmosphere in parts per 10,000. So it's not as rare as ozone, which is parts per million, but parts per 10,000. I think we should all reflect on what those few facts I've given you mean. The very idea that humans can influence the gaseous composition of our atmosphere at a level of parts per 10,000 is profoundly disturbing to me. I mean, what it tells me is that humans have become such a powerful influence, or a powerful element, really, of life on Earth, that we're now able to do things that most other species, single species, can't do. There's 6.6 billion of us human beings on Earth, and more and more of us are getting access to the sort of lifestyles that you and I enjoy. I heard an economist recently talking about China who said that 40 years from now, those 1.3, they're probably 1.6 billion Chinese by then, will all be enjoying a quality of life similar to that you and I enjoy today. That is a huge imposition on our planet, and one that simply can't happen without us going through a new industrial revolution that develops a cleaner base, a cleaner, more efficient base to support the affluence that we all enjoy. If you doubt that humans could be powerful enough to interfere with the atmosphere at that sort of fundamental level, as Dr. Gray suggests, I just say to you, to get a gut feeling of it, go online and try to Google an image of our Earth at night. If you do that, you'll see that Earth is just lit up like a Christmas tree. There's electric lighting everywhere on our planet now, except in North Korea, a little dark spot. But, it's amazing to me that all that light is by and large supported by the burning of fossil fuels. And yet in my grandmother's time, this planet of ours was a beautiful dark orb at night. It wasn't lit up like that. It just gives you a gut sense of how influential we now are in terms of this planetary system of ours. At the beginning of the Industrial Revolution in 1800, the greenhouse gas concentration in our atmosphere was at about 300 parts per million of what's called carbon dioxide equivalent. And I need to just explain to you what carbon dioxide equivalent is. There's 30 greenhouse gases. They all have different... they all affect the atmosphere or the heat balance of our planet in different ways. And in order to get a sort of a handle or to express their cumulative impact, scientists have invented this thing of carbon dioxide equivalent. Basically, what they do is convert the power of those greenhouse gases to warm into a single gas, the power of a single gas. It's a bit like taking a basket of currencies and converting it into a single currency. So that currency is carbon dioxide. We call it carbon dioxide equivalent. So 3 parts per 10,000 in 1800. Next month, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change will release a very important report that establishes what the current concentration of greenhouse gases is in our atmosphere. That report is known as the Synthesis Report, and it's of the fourth assessment report, and these bureaucrats love these long and redundant titles, but anyway, it's worth having a look at, because that report will, I think, deliver some of the most disturbing news that our species as a whole has ever received. What it will say is that as of mid-2005, the CO2 equivalent, the concentration of CO2 equivalent in our atmosphere, is at about 4.55 parts per 10,000. Now, that's 50% greater than the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, but why is that an important figure? Ever since scientists analysed the ice cores that they drew from the Antarctic ice cap and the Greenland ice cap, they've realised that Earth's climate can change abruptly and at a very large scale. That really is the definition of dangerous climate change. Any big, fast-moving things are dangerous to us. We know that inherently when we try to cross a road, you know. We know it when we try to pay our bills. If we get a big one that's got to be paid tomorrow, it generally gets us to rattle our dags, as we say in Australia, a bit more quickly than we would. If it's a small bill, it needs to be paid in a month's time. So big, fast-moving things dominate the environmental agenda as well. This issue of dangerous climate change is particularly pertinent today because scientists have been trying to understand when the next big climate shift will occur, how much pollution the atmosphere can sustain before it. We see another great shift. I should just spend a minute or two talking about these ice cores, because you need to understand, really, that I think how powerful they are in terms of telling us about past climate. These ice cores are in the Antarctic. They go down about 2 miles. They record 640,000 years of Earth history. In Greenland, they go down about, I think, a similar distance, but they cover about 130,000 years of Earth history. Earlier in the year, I visited the University of Copenhagen ice core store and saw some of these ice cores. They're about that round, and they're kept in metre or yard-long lengths, roughly. And you can see these bands in them. They're about an inch wide in the section that I saw, or sections I saw. And the guy who was showing me this, the Dane who was showing me these ice cores, said, "Well, see that band in the middle of the ice, this section here?" And I had a look at it. It was about an inch thick, you know. He said, "That fell as snow over the Greenland ice cap in the year that Jesus was born." I thought, wow, that's pretty amazing, because these bands, you know, they record annual change, you know, annual snowfalls. He said, "See those little speckles in the ice core?" He said, "Those speckles are little bubbles of air that were trapped by the snow as it fell and have really remained as samples of that ancient atmosphere of the year AD 1. And he said, "The atmosphere is incredibly dynamic. It, you know, the gases in it shift around the whole planet over weeks and months." And he said, they give us a really good record of life as it was back then. He said, "You know, in fact, the atmosphere is so dynamic, I reckon that in those bubbles there's probably a few molecules breathed out by the Holy Family in that first year." It's pretty amazing. Just don't tell the Pope. We'll have another relic on our hands. But anyway. But they're also an incredible archive of our planet's past. Because there's so many things we can look at in those air bubbles that tell us about conditions of life on Earth. You know, we can look at the isotopes of oxygen to tell us about temperature, and the isotopes of carbon to tell us about the condition of the oceans. We can look at methyl sulfonic acid to tell us about algal activity at the surface of the ocean and planktonic activity. We can look at dust particles in those air bubbles to tell us about wind direction and wind speed and vegetation cover on the land. And they're just a few examples of the hundreds of things that are measured by scientists. Basically, what those ice cores give us are a wonderful archive of year-by-year change of our planet, the yearbook of our planet, you know. And what we see in those ice cores, and we didn't appreciate before we had them, is that within just a matter of a few years, Earth's climate can shift abruptly from one stable state that it's been in for a very long time into another. So that was really the great revelation that had scientists talking about dangerous climate change, trying to establish how much greenhouse gas the atmosphere could support before the climate shifts again. The best computer modelling we have, which is by no means perfect, but it gives us a general indication, suggests that at about the level of greenhouse gas that we have in the atmosphere today, we stand a 20% chance of suffering from dangerous climate change. And that is just a truly unacceptable risk. I mean, you know, in 1994, the governments of the Earth got together and pledged to keep citizens safe from dangerous climate change. We now know that they've failed to keep that pledge. We are now in the danger zone. We really are, and it's an urgent issue now for us to start pulling some of that gas out of the air and reducing the emissions that we put into the atmosphere. It's important to understand that by the good grace of some other pollutants, some of that warming has been masked. So China is still burning a lot of sulfur-rich coal, and that sulfur is acting to cool our planet. Jet contrails cool our planet, and particulate matter can cool our planet. So the warming we're suffering today is consistent with the sort of warming you'd expect from about 3.75 parts per 10,000 of CO2 equivalent. So about 0.75 parts are being masked by those cooling factors. But those cooling agents are so short-lived in the atmosphere. We learned earlier that sulfur only lasts a matter of hours in the atmosphere. Particulates are the same. Jet contrails are the same. But the greenhouse gases last a century. So I see that gas burden, the greenhouse gas burden, as a sort of Damocles hanging over our head, and a thread that's holding it back are these other pollutants that we could, as China cleans up its act, could really release the greenhouse gases to do their worst. In the light of that, what do we need to do to deal with this problem? We need to do, I think, three things, or we have three principal tools in our toolkit to deal with this. The first of them is just reduce our emissions. We've been talking about it for decades now and we've done nothing. But the sort of work that's now being done, for example, in California, really leads the way. Governor Schwarzenegger has pledged to reduce our emissions by 80%, or California's emissions by 80%, in the next 40 years. What that really means is that Californians are going to be living in an effectively decarbonised economy 4 decades from now. Now, you know, a lot of you might remember Elvis and the Beatles. They're sort of 4 decades and more back in the past, you know. 4 decades is not a long time to achieve true independence from fossil fuel burning. But we can do it, and we will do it. It's the sort of target that absolutely needs to happen. And it will happen through good regulation. And I just want to talk very briefly about the effectiveness of Californian regulation so far. You know, if you compare the motor industry, the vehicle industry, with the outboard motor industry, you see some very salutary things. California has moved to regulate outboard motors, so the things you put on your boats, very effectively. They were able to do it because the outboard industry is just not all that big, and California is pretty big, and they were able to just get their way. The motor industry, which they've been trying to regulate, has been just too big to be kind of bullied into submission, made to toe the line. They keep on suing California in the Supreme Court and delaying things and dragging it out as long as they can. What's the end result? The end result is, I hate to be rude, but I've got to be blunt, no one buys American cars overseas today, you know. Next year, the rules in China for motor vehicle sales are going to be such that you won't be able to sell American cars in China. They just don't meet the emission standards. And you see what's happening. The Japanese, who've had good regulation, have taken over the world. What's happened with the outboard motor industry? Evinrude, who were one of the big producers of outboard motors, as a result of that good regulation, have produced the world's most revolutionary, non-polluting, quiet and efficient outboard motor I think that's ever been developed. It's called this Evinrude E-Tech. I have one. I know about these things. But, you know, it's the only outboard motor in the world that's accredited to be sold in, or that meets emission standards for Europe and California. And it's going to do for the Apple motor industry what Toyota's hybrids have done for the car industry. So it just shows that it's not as if America's short of genius or great engineers or anything else. You know, if the regulation's right, you guys can take over the world. You've done it in the past. You do it again in various industry sectors. It's the lack of good regulation that's holding back American industry, in my view, and nothing shows it more clearly than that comparison that I just laid out. The world is moving on this, and as we move to 80% emissions reductions, there's going to be more and more pressure on the polluting industries. We're going to have to deal with that problem. In order to get those sort of emission reductions, we're going to have to get the polluters to pay a significant price, probably in the order of $70 a tonne for their pollution. At that sort of level, most of the renewables, including clean coal technology and so forth, becomes very cost-effective to get to market. And some wonderful things happen in terms of carbon sequestration in our soils, which I'll spend a minute explaining. If $70 a tonne sounds like a lot, just consider what has happened with the recent fuel price rises in this country. I know you used to pay around $2 a gallon, you're now paying $3. If you try to calculate what that means in terms of a carbon price, in other words, you ask how much of a tax would we have needed to put on the oil industry to raise prices that high, what you find is that the cost would be between $200 and $300 a tonne to do that. So we're talking about $70 a tonne, which is what? It's somewhere between a third and a fourth of that cost. People have adjusted to the high fuel prices in this country. It hasn't sent the country broke. We're not talking about major imposts here. We're talking about reasonable imposts that will bring, I think, increased prosperity to this country in the medium term. Unfortunately, it's not going to be enough just to reduce our emissions in future. We're also going to have to draw some of the gas out of the air. And this atmosphere of ours is now burdened with about 200 gigatons of carbon that wasn't there in the past. That's built up since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. And I see that gas as being... It's the historic debt that we owe the world, you know, because we're the people who benefited from the Industrial Revolution. So we took the benefits of the process and we burdened the world with the pollution that resulted from that process. And I've been searching for ways to sort of... I think we all should be searching for ways as well to repay that debt. One important way of doing it is the conservation of tropical forests. Half of the world's tropical forests have already been cleared. They're incredibly important in regulating Earth's climate, not just from the carbon they sequester, but because of the transpiration through their leaves that cools our planet. Studies suggest that we could repay about half of that debt, at least, that historic debt, so 100 gigatons of carbon, which, as Aussies would say, is a shitload of carbon. I mean, I won't explain how much a gigaton is, but a bloody lot, by regrowing some of those tropical forests. How would we ever achieve that? You know, I've worked in the tropics. I know how hard it is to deal fairly with people in that part of the world. I think you guys invented the answer, you Americans. If we could get a computer with an internet connection in every primary school in the tropics, you and I could go online using Google Earth or eBay and, you know, Google up 500 villages in Panama, you know, that want to sell their carbon, read about the villages, look at where they want to plant their carbon, and decide you're going to buy some of your climate security by paying those people online. The money could be held in escrow by an NGO and be paid once the carbon is sequestered, and we know it was sequestered because we could use satellite surveillance, which is already available, to be able to see that. What a wonderful tool to deal just directly, you know, a wealth transfer between the wealthiest people on the planet and some of the poorest. You know, they improving that on the planet, us purchasing our climate security. Very, very real possibilities using these tools, these new tools, to save ourselves and do something great in terms of social issues. There's a whole lot of other technologies that are going to come to the fore within the next couple of decades. Most important of them in the agricultural sector are the char-based technologies. These are technologies that allow farmers to take crop waste and turn it into charcoal. Just need to explain how this works. If you grow a crop of corn, today the farmer sells the corn off to market and then he probably just forgets about the stalks or perhaps ploughs it back into the field or lets some cows eat it or something. The end result is that those corn stalks rot away and the CO2 they hold goes back into the atmosphere within a year or so. If the farmer instead had taken those corn stalks and put them into what's called a pyrolysis machine, which is a simple charcoal-making machine, And what happens in that machine is you burn that crop waste in the partial absence of oxygen. If he had done that, he'd generate a synthetic gas at one end that could be burned to generate electricity, or perhaps develop a biofuel, which could be used for transport. And at the other end, you'd get charcoal. And what that means is that the farmer then gets a fourfold dividend. He gets to sell his crop. He gets to sell either electricity or a biofuel. He gets paid under a Kyoto-like mechanism to sequester charcoal in the soil. And that charcoal improves soil quality, so you get a better crop next year. It's a fantastic system. We need a carbon price of about $40 a tonne to realise that dream. But once we get that, 15 years from now, we could be pulling 10 gigatons of carbon per year out of the atmosphere using that technology. That is 5% of the historic debt, 5% of the burden. Enormously powerful. So these are the things we need to do. We need to get on with emissions reductions with as steep as we can over the next 40 years. We need to use the tropical forests and harness those to be drawing 10 gigatons of carbon out of the year. We need to use the char-based technologies to draw another 10 out of the atmosphere per year. And at that rate, when we're pulling down the standing stock at 10%, we're reducing the emissions into the atmosphere very substantially. We are well on the way to beating this problem. It's not an insolvable problem. It's a simply soluble problem that common sense economics and a common sense approach that we can all take can have a huge impact. I just want to emphasise that the ball truly is in our court in this issue today. You know, the world got together in 1997 to try to broker another protocol, the Kyoto Protocol. And we failed at that because two countries failed to join, Australia and the United States. As a result of that, we've had a decade of confusion and loss. No one's known quite what to do. But recently, things have started to change. The Chinese, for one, know that they face a very serious problem in terms of climate change now. And within the last month or two, they've said that if the developed world agrees on a protocol and agrees on reductions, emission reductions, they will join with us. And what that statement does is put the ball firmly back in our court. In December 2009 in Copenhagen, at a time when you'll have a new president, we hopefully will have a new prime minister. Well, we've got an election on the 24th of November. We will all meet, the nations of the world will meet, to try to broker a new protocol to replace Kyoto. It's going to be the most important meeting of our times, I think, because if we succeed at that meeting, we'll be on a trajectory towards healing. If we fail, the level of risk that we face every year from this problem will simply continue to grow. I do think that this issue and the whole issue of sustainability is the focal issue for our times. You know, each century, I think, has its own challenges and its own issues. You know, if you go back to the 19th century, the great challenges then were all about social justice. I mean, it's hard for us to conceive, but at the start of the 19th century, it was perfectly legal and acceptable almost anywhere in the world to own another human being. It sort of seems bizarre today, but that was the case. People worked in the most appalling conditions and child labour was universal. Women didn't have the vote. In fact, relatively few men had the vote. And, you know, the great and the good among us, the people who really cared and saw what the issues were, worked hard through that century to produce a better world. And against all the odds, they won. You know, at the end of the 19th century, universal suffrage was thinkable. Slavery had been abolished. People had much better working conditions. The 20th century, which I suppose was my century, really, where I straddle both, but for many people in the room, that was their century. You know, the challenges were different. Then it was an issue really of war and peace. You know, people lived through two horrendous world wars and realised a third could destroy humanity. And again, the best of us set our minds to creating the institutions that would keep us safe from that peril. And so the United Nations came into being and the European Union and the anti-ballistic missile treaties and so forth. You know, I think that, and of course we benefited from all of that work. We wouldn't be here today without those pioneers who pushed that forward. And we're going to continue to have social issues in the 21st century, and we're going to continue to have issues of war and peace, but that's not what's going to define this century. You know, with a projected 9 billion people on our planet in the middle of this century and the already self-evident constraints that we face in terms of resources such as water, food security and so forth. It is absolutely clear to me that the great enterprise of this century is going to be living sustainably and regulating the global commons, the global atmosphere, you know. That they're they'll be the great treaties, the things that will lay the foundation for a better future for humanity. That's where the big effort is going to be for us. This is a little bit different, I suppose, from the 19th century, though, because if we fail at this, then I think we'll fail to hold our global civilization together. That's about all I wanted to say. I know it seems like a lot, but I think I've run out of time, and I should step aside now, and we'll soon have discussion and conversation. Thank you very much.
That concludes the reading for this event. Up next is the conversation.
Timothy Fritjof Flannery.
Yes.
You are distantly related to the Norwegian explorer diplomat Fritjof Nansen, won the 1922 Nobel Peace Prize.
That's right, yeah.
You, Tim Flannery, Sir David Attenborough called you one of the all-time great explorers like Dr. David Livingstone. You have discovered more than 70 species. What is it like to discover a species?
Oh, wow. Well, it comes in different forms, you know, because sometimes you're not quite sure what you've actually discovered. Sometimes when I've been working in Papua New Guinea or the Pacific Islands, I've found some animals or some jawbones and haven't been entirely sure what they were, and then you've got to go back to a museum and do comparisons, and it's sort of like a slow awakening that this is a new species. But other times, you go into the field and you see an animal which you just know is totally unknown, is so distinctive and so different. And that's just such a buzz for me, because you think, how could it be in the 1990s, as it was, mid-1990s, animals the size of Labrador dogs, you know, could remain unknown? So that's been amazing to do.
What do you consider your greatest discovery?
Well, probably that I discovered a tree kangaroo in West Papua in 1997. And look, could I just say that when I say I discovered it, it's the wrong phraseology, because the local people often but not always know about these animals, and in this case they did know about this animal. So my role really was just like a wedding broker. I just introduced the creature to the world. You know, they already knew about it. But I was like the first outsider to see it, you know, and it was, this animal was about the size of a Labrador dog, about that high, black and white, like a little panda, and yet it was a kangaroo. And it lived in alpine meadows below the glaciers in the highest mountains in West Papua, which is a magical environment, you know, full of rhododendrons and birds of paradise. It's just a beautiful, beautiful place.
So how did you become a paleontologist, mammalogist, environmental historian, as you describe it? When did it happen? Well, elementary school, before?
I just was always interested in nature. You know, I've loved the natural world. And I suppose I was one of those kids who was perhaps a little bit solitary and just enjoyed being out in nature. And I grew up in the city of Melbourne, which has a large bay, and I spent a lot of my childhood snorkeling in the bay and just loved that environment. You could leave the suburbs behind. It was like a wild frontier down there. It was wonderful. There was all sorts of fish, and there was fossils even in the bay. But as it happened, I went to a school where, I ended up anyway studying humanities, and I was going to be a high school teacher. But I had a particularly horrible class of year nines, like 15-year-olds. And so I was soon convinced that wasn't my role. So I went and did study geology. So,
when did you first leave Australia?
I was 26 when I first left Australia, and I went to Papua New Guinea. So, that was my first field trip, and I just fell in love with the country. You know, it was extraordinary going from Australia to Papua New Guinea, because our native people had by and large been displaced and their relationship with the land had broken down. Whereas when I went to Papua New Guinea, I found basically the same people, but living in on their own land, in harmony with nature, as they had for thousands of years. And that to me was a wonderful revelation, to actually see that, see people live like that. It just, the greatest gift that I've ever had was given to me by those Papua New Guineans, who let me see life through a different pair of eyes from the Western eyes that we have, and that's, I think, been very important.
Can you talk about the Australian Aborigines and the way they have dealt with nature and the land, and what you feel we, or Australians, have to learn from then going forward from today?
Yeah, look, I ended up doing quite a bit of work with Aboriginal people because I was director of a museum for 7 years, and that museum had the biggest collection of Aboriginal material artefacts, and we had a program of giving back and loaning back material for ceremonies and this sort of stuff. So I got to meet a lot of the senior people, senior men and whatever. And you realise that those people have certain things that we don't have anymore. Can I spend a minute on this? It's kind of interesting. I reckon that when we settled down 10,000 years ago in those villages and natural selection started to select for the cleanly, you know, we lost quite a lot, because you think about the way an Aboriginal person lives. They've got to get up in the morning, find some food, keep the family together, defend them from any attacks, any other people. They've got to make their own tools, build their own hut, you know, deal with people on an equal basis. There's no law, there's tribal law, but there's no, you know, government as such. So they have to do everything, and they are just extraordinarily smart and capable people for that very reason. Whereas we are just highly specialised. You know, we don't know how to make our own tools or make our own house. We pay other people to do that, you know. And the challenges in our life are so much lesser than theirs that their skills are totally honed. I think they're much smarter than us, because they just deal with all of those problems on a daily basis. And, of course, part of that is sustainability. How do you harvest resources on the land that will give you a long-term future? And so they are extraordinarily perceptive of nature and the way nature works, and deeply knowledgeable about how to use the resources on the land in a way that doesn't drive it to impoverishment.
Explain what fire sticks are.
Well, one of the great tools Aboriginal people use is fire. We call it fire stick farming because it bears a strong resemblance to farming, even though there's no ploughs involved and there's no domesticated crops. What Aboriginal people will do is burn the country in particular ways at particular time of year to unlock food resources. Some of those are vegetable food resources that will come up after the fire. Others are animals. So they'll burn in a way that will attract kangaroos into an area that makes them easier to hunt, for example. So the fire stick is the tool for broadacre land management. It's not the plough, but it's every bit as effective, really, in terms of yielding resources.
What do you think Australians can learn from using that, and compare what we are doing today, coal burning?
Oh, my goodness. We Australians are people that live by resource extraction, and mining is big in our country. We're the world's largest coal exporter, you know. And it's a deeply immoral trade in some ways, because we love the money that trade brings, but we don't want to know about the global treaties that help us deal with the unintended consequences of that trade, the Kyoto Protocol. And unfortunately, we've used our soils in Australia and our agricultural systems and our water in a way that's very akin to mining. We've just eaten our way through the resource base. We're a frontier people, a bit like Americans, and have destroyed the wealth of the land as we've move through it. So we've got a huge amount to learn from Aboriginal people in that regard. In some small ways, you know, they're amazing. Aboriginal people were nomadic, so material goods didn't mean anything much to them, you know. They're highly skilled at using the tools they have, and it's the human intellect that makes the tool a great thing. The tool itself's not very sophisticated, it's the way you use it. And, of course, intellectual property was all important to them. It's amazing. As a museum director, when I was working with these people, their grasp of intellectual property was just acute. You know, the sort of stuff we grapple with as we talk about copyrights for books and CDs, they intuitively understood, because they didn't want to trade goods. Trade was very important to them because it allowed you to meet other people. but you don't want to be carrying a stone around with you or something to give them because that's hard work. In other words, but you could trade a song, you know, or a design, or a ceremony. And so they have a great, great sense of intellectual property protection. They should be writing our intellectual copyright laws, really, and they do a very good job of it. Yeah.
Speaking of what we have to learn from Aboriginal people, I wanted to ask you about the dedication in your book, Throw 'Em Way Leg. That means take a journey?
It means hit the road, really. It's like everyone walks in New Guinea, and I should just tell you a funny story, if I could, about that. It's a difficult title for people to get their heads around, and it's been misquoted as everything, but I was in New York a few years ago, and this sort of dizzy blonde came up to me after my talk and said, "Oh, I love your book, Throw Your Leg My Way." And I thought, I wish I'd thought of that. I should have caught that. No.
Well, you dedicate the book to Jim Bob Moffat, his successors, and all the other CEOs of mining companies with interests in Melanesia, in the hope that through reading it, they will understand a little better the people whose lives they so profoundly change. Jim Bob Moffat, the CEO of Freeport-McMoRan, talk about the power of this corporation, and then I want to talk about corporate power overall.
Well, the Freeport-McMoRan runs a copper mine, copper and gold mine, in West Papua, and it's in one of the most remote and difficult of access on our planet, and it's right in the middle of an area of really fairly untouched tribal societies, and the impacts are just many, many fold. I mean, the company got in at a stage where Suharto was in power, and really the military have got access to this area through the mine and benefit greatly from the mine, and also use their position there to suppress local people. The Indonesian military is a pretty tough organisation. They're very brutalised people. They have brutal training for their troops, and they look down upon these naked black Melanesians, really. I think sometimes seeing them as less than human, and certainly not Indonesian citizens as such. And I, just as one small example, I was on the spot when a Melanesian child, a 14-year-old boy, was murdered by employees of the company, which was just horrible. I wrote about it in the book, but it made me very, very angry because it was so unnecessary and so stupid.
How
and so
happen?
Brutal. The mine, of course, is a great attractor for these indigenous people who live right on the edge. First of all, they want to see the bigger world, you know, so they'll walk across the mountain range to come into the mine area. And then there's food, abundance of food. I mean, the Americans there throw away so much. So an oil drum or a kerosene drum that they consider empty has enough kerosene in it to run a family lamp for a month, you know. So a bit of clothing that's thrown away is like a precious gift to these people, where it's rubbish to the Americans. And so that this is, you know, you can imagine how it attracts people. And every now and again, the Indonesian military and the guards get everyone to leave town and go back. And this particular day, what they do is take them up to the top of a pass and get them to walk then through it's actually a very dangerous alpine area, where if the weather changes, people can freeze to death. This group was walking across this area, up near a glacier, and the young boy was sick. He had pneumonia, we think, or had lung problems and a sore foot. And his sister said that she would go back with him, walk back to the mine to get medical help. They got to the edge of the mining area, and the military were waiting there for anyone came back, and they just laid into him, just kicked him and left him there with his sister. And I was working up near the glacier, and a local man I was working with told me there was two children in a cave. So we went to this cave and found, it was the very day he'd been beaten, found him laying there in the cave. I asked what had happened. He explained the situation. So we aborted our trip and carried the boy back and brought his sister back. Past the mine, guards who were jeering at us as we came in, tried to seek help. The boy was whisked away to the hospital, which was run by Indonesians. I tried to see him that evening and was denied access, tried to see him the next morning and was denied access, and then was told he died. Now, his injuries weren't consistent, in my view, as a non-physician, with that sort of outcome. I don't know what happened. His sister was whisked away by village people, thankfully, and was never seen again. I don't know where she went to. But it just made me so angry because it was so unnecessary and so stupid, you know. And you know, I went back. I kept on hounding them about this. I went every time I made another visit. I said, "Well, have you made any progress in this murder case?" And the guy who was running security at the mine, when I went back after about 6 months, I said, "Well, what case was that?" And I said, "I spent 3 hours in your office 6 months ago, giving you a detailed report of the murder of a boy by your employees." And he said, "Oh, I can't. Now I remember a bit." But it was like, it was, I don't know whether it was so horrendous he was blocking it out of his mind or whether he had genuinely forgotten or what. But it was just a horrendous circumstance.
Well, from a corporation like Freeport-McMoRan that has spent years shoring up the Indonesian dictatorship of Suharto, I think Kissinger served on its board as well, to even larger corporations like ExxonMobil. I wanted to talk about the environment in these companies that are larger than the economies of many countries in the world. I recently moderated an event at Stanford University where they have the GCEP program, which is a global climate program that is funded by several corporations, mainly ExxonMobil, to the tune of $220 million. BP has given to the University of California, Berkeley, $500 million over 10 years. And I wanted to ask about the power of these corporations in determining the discourse around global climate change. When I moderated this panel, George Shultz, the former Secretary of State, was one of the panelists. And he was talking, he prides himself on driving a Prius and on being an environmentalist. He was talking about how do you get China to appreciate the problem of global warming. And I asked, which does he think is more difficult, getting China to appreciate the issue of global warming or ExxonMobil? He ripped off his microphone. He was very angry. But what about the power of these corporations?
Well, look, they may seem powerful, and they've temporarily stolen the march by subverting democracy and lying to the people. But I don't think in the longer term that they are powerful, because they all only operate by our good grace. Every company has a social license to operate, and when that social license to operate is withdrawn, they find themselves in serious difficulties. And we've seen it with numerous examples in Australia in my lifetime of companies who've crossed the line and have simply ceased to exist or had to move offshore, you know, or faced horrendous consequences. And
companies have only gotten more powerful. ExxonMobil just beats its own record every year in its level of profits, the most wealthy corporation in the world.
That's right. But the pollution that they've put in the atmosphere and that has built up as a result of the lies they've told the public is still there and is very quantifiable and is increasingly easily related to shifts in climate that we're seeing. So the liability they've built up is going to be there for a century. And I was very interested. I was in New Orleans last year and met a lawyer who was taking the 50 largest polluters to court for damages suffered by the people of Mississippi, I think it was, as a result of that, the cyclone activity over 2005. And I asked him what it was like in court. And he said, "Well, you know those guys," he said, "they've got the same smug smiles on their faces that the tobacco industry had 30 years ago when I first went after them." And I thought, that tells me something that, you know, this guy's not in it for the short term. Right. So there are consequences, and there should be consequences of everything that happens in the world. No one gets away scot-free with these things. Whether it will happen in time, whether they've been good enough deceivers to destroy us all, we won't know for some years. But I suspect that they won't. I suspect there still is time, and the issue won't go away for those companies.
What's happening in this country today? The fires raging in Southern California, the drought throughout the Southeast, the drenching rain in New Orleans, as if they could take anything else.
we get a lot of very good coverage of the images of extreme weather in the corporate networks, but they rarely say those two words together, global warming, with all of the wall-to-wall coverage. You have these words vacuumed off of government websites. Government studies, they're constantly being taken out before they are issued to the public, those words. Can you explain how a drought, tremendous rainfall, and fires are linked to each other?
Sure. But look, could I just say before I do that, I have a little motto now that I carry with me because I reckon we've only all got one life and we have to make a maximum difference. I reckon never get angry, just get even. So don't ever get angry at them, just make sure you get them out when they need to, you know, you need to get them out. But in terms of the of those issues that you talked about, one of the key things to understand is that as an atmosphere warms, it becomes more energetic. And the reason it becomes more energetic is that it holds more water vapour, and water vapour is latent heat energy that drives a lot of the processes in the atmosphere. So we can expect to see more severe storms on average. Now, there are many confounding factors here. So there are cycles of hurricane activity in the Atlantic that mask that trajectory of increased intensity, because one year we'll have a lot of storms, the next year none. That's more like weather than climate. Yeah? So we've got to be careful when we talk about these events to say that, you know, they're consistent with what we expect from a warming atmosphere, but we can't ever say that single event is the cause by that. So hurricanes are one good case. We've, you know, the big global studies have shown that the energy budget, if you want, of tropical storms and hurricanes globally has increased by 60% in the last 30 years, which is consistent with what you expect from a warming atmosphere. Droughts are a similar sort of thing, although here the science, we're really trying to scrambling to catch up. You know, what we've, I think, has happened is that as we've modelled climate, we have failed to understand the tremendous importance of what's called evapotranspiration, and that is evaporation of moisture from the atmosphere and transpiration from plants. And water deficits are a major global problem now, and we're starting to really, I think scientists are starting to focus more on this issue because it is one of the great gaps in our knowledge in that area. Could I just talk about the wildfires briefly? Again, we're seeing a global signature of climate change here, that earlier in the year, Greece suffered extreme wildfires. And Greece is in a Mediterranean climate like California. The year before that, it was Australia. We have a Mediterranean climate in southern Australia, the same thing. And what these Mediterranean climates all have in common is they're adjacent to deserts, and as our planet warms, those hot areas expand and we get more stress put on those vegetation in those Mediterranean climates. So we can expect more of those sort of events as the climate shifts further. And the way I try to think about the Greek fires, which is the one I perhaps know better than the Californian ones here, is that, you know, really as our climate warms and the deserts expand, the Sahara is trying to move up into Greece, you know, and the Sahara is inconsistent with a lot of plant matter. You know, you see those drier conditions may eventually alter forests throughout, particularly southern Greece.
In The Weathermakers, in your chapter, The Pack of Jokers, you talk about the importance of positive feedback loops, the concert of the three scenarios. Explain what they are.
Well, at that stage, when I wrote the book, I tried to pick what I thought were the three most proximate, if you want, or most immediate threats to humanity that we needed big, big triggers to climate shifts. Now, it turns out that 2 years on, I probably would have picked different shifts. I would have particularly picked water availability as one. But let's deal just with those three that I talked about there. They were a shutdown of the Gulf Stream, which will bring colder conditions to Europe. And that is... The risk of a shutdown of the Gulf Stream is fairly low. It's on the order of 5%.
Explain how that happened.
The Gulf Stream is a great current in the Atlantic Ocean that carries warm, salty water northwards into the North Atlantic and carries with it a lot of heat. So about a third of Europe's heat budget is brought up by the Gulf Stream. It doesn't come from the sun directly. It comes from the Gulf Stream. Now, what we know has happened in the past is that as ice has melted across the Northern Hemisphere, a layer of fresh waters laid on the surface of the Atlantic and prevented the sinking of those salty waters, and so the Gulf Stream's basically stopped moving and the heat transfer system has ceased. That means Europe gets very cold, heat builds up elsewhere in the system. It happened 12,000 years ago, and it's happened partially on several occasions since. You'd think it'd be easy to measure the Gulf Stream, wouldn't you? I mean, it's like a river in the sea. It's incredibly complicated and difficult to do. So our measurements are not what we'd hope. The computer modelling, as I said, suggests that it's pretty hard, actually, to shut down the Gulf Stream, and that the chances of it happening this century are on the order of 5% or so. It's one of those things. To be honest with you, we'll probably only know it's happened once it's happened. You know, it's very difficult to see it coming. The other things I mentioned were the...
If it does happen, what happens?
Well, depends. If it's a total shutdown, Europe is going to be in trouble and it's going to get very cold, you know, particularly in winters. And all of that heat has to go somewhere. So where's it going to go? At the moment, we don't know. But my guess is the Gulf of Mexico is a good candidate, you know. And already, you know, in that hurricane season in 2005, sea surface temperatures in the Gulf were about 30 degrees C, which is too warm to enjoy swimming, really. I mean, you know, so and that heat, that deep pool of hot water is what drives these hurricanes in that area. So these are, you know, it's very difficult to project using the computer modelling how the world's going to reorganise itself with those sort of shifts. You know, we're dealing with an extraordinarily complex system, really, that we've only begun to understand. I mean, the people probably need to know that, you know, until the last couple of years, you couldn't go to university and do a climate change science degree. You know, all of us who have come through something else, with atmospheric physics or paleontology like myself or oceanography or whatever, this is a new kind of science. We haven't been thinking in this global way before. We've had this very reductionist approach to science where you study the individual little bits and hope you'll build a big picture. We know that just doesn't work. Sometimes you've got to take a big picture view.
Explain the other two scenarios.
Yeah, well, just look, just for the matter of time, I'll probably give one concentrate on one, which is the clath rates, if you want, or the methane gas held in ice, which is... I hadn't any idea about this until I started researching the book, but the bottom of the ocean is full of ice that burns, which is ice that has, under pressure, a lot of methane in it. And it's kept in that form by pressure and temperature, and there's a lot of it in the Arctic Ocean. So as the Arctic Ocean warms, if the ice melts, we are likely to see a release of methane from those clath rates. And methane, of course, is a very, very potent greenhouse gas. So if we see enough of that melting of clath rates, we'll have a rapid change because the build-up of methane will heat our planet very dramatically.
And what would happen to the Amazon?
Well, the Amazon forests are a very interesting forest. I mentioned evapotranspiration before, which is that, you know, water falls to the surface of our planet, then evaporates off or transpires through plants and becomes rain again. Well, the Amazon is maintained by evaporation of its own water, really. You know, the amount of water coming into the system is not all that great, but it gets recycled many times over in the system. One of the problems that looks like it is going to occur with climate change is that we'll get less rainfall initially in the Amazon and more carbon dioxide in the air, so the plants don't transpire as much. It's complex science, so I haven't got time to go through it all here. But what that means is that there'll be a dramatic decline in rainfall over the Amazon, proportionately much greater than we see elsewhere on the planet, which would lead to a death of those trees. And the computer modelling suggests that conditions then become so hostile it's hard to imagine what sort of vegetation would grow in the place of that forest. It may be very, very sparse, semi-desert vegetation.
I think the power of your work is with all these devastating sort of prophecies of what can happen. You're always talking about how we can turn this around. Explain what geothermia is.
Yeah, well, that's an idea that I love. It was, you know, Nikola Tesla said it, you know, first. He said there's a lot of heat energy between the middle of our planet and where we stand on it, and if we could ever drill into that and access it, we'd have a limitless power supply. It turns out that geothermal energy has been grossly underestimated, the potential of geothermal energy to generate electricity. And In Australia, we have the world's best geothermal resource. We were thought to be singularly poor 10 years ago in geothermal energy, but this amazing resource was discovered by oil and gas explorers. It's a body of granite that is heated to 270 degrees Celsius. The fluid in it is at 5,000 psi. It's fractured horizontally, so it's got great circulation capacity. There's enough energy in that deposit to power the Australian economy for a century if we can unlock it.
Where is it?
It's in central Australia, right near Alice Springs and Lake Eyre, that area out there. But the funny thing about this was, you know, it was discovered by an oil and gas explorer, and shows you how these people think. You know, what they discovered was a ring of oil-bearing rocks and then a ring of gas-bearing rocks, and in the middle, these hot rocks that had driven all the oil and gas off, you know. And they thought, well, we've got the oil and we've got the gas, we can post the rest of the information publicly, which they did, not realising they'd given away an energy source probably 10 times bigger than anything that they had in oil and gas. But anyway, so a company obviously took that and set up this new company called Geodynamics, and they're drilling now. We'll know by Christmas time this year as to whether the first circulation tests are working or not. And if they do work, we will have a massive new and absolutely clean energy source in Australia that will allow us to do minerals processing and anything else we want on a very large scale.
There is so much potential, and we know about wind and solar energy. The question is, where is the political will, and is it dictated by corporations believing where they can make profit and where they can't? And I wanted to follow up on that because you're not just a scientist and an environmental historian. You're an advisor to prime ministers and governors in Australia. You're named Australian of the Year for 2007. How do you pressure, advise these politicians who have a lot of other pressures on them that they respond to perhaps more than you?
Yeah, and it's been a tough ride so far, I can tell you. And in some ways, the way I've done it is by influencing public opinion, because that's what influences politicians, you know. But you can talk to them as well, and I try to talk to them about the lobbying they'll get from the fossil fuel industry, because they'll reflect or parrot back to me what the fossil fuel industry is telling them. And I say, well, look, you know, imagine if you were 30 years ago being lobbied by the typewriter industry, who were saying, you know, look, I've heard of this new technology, it's called computers, you know, and if we ever let that get into our homes, you're going to have child pornography in every home in the country, you'll have possibility of terrorists collaborating to destroy our nation, you know. We've got to stop this, help us typewriter people stay in business, you know. And they probably would have won the argument if they'd been smart enough to run it and had enough money to run it, and the world would have been a far poorer place. And exactly the same thing's happening now with the fossil fuel industry. And they're telling a lot of lies about these new energy sources because they just want to make another few years' fat profits before they start to be put out of business. But the time has come when we have to change. And the other thing that I say to them is, you know, the smart energy companies don't see themselves as oil companies or coal companies. They're energy companies. And probably the best example of that is BP, you know. It used to be British Petroleum, it's now Beyond Petroleum. It's now the world's largest manufacturer of solar panels. And they can see what's happening and are moving in the right direction. So I think we've got to remain positive with this. We've got to give people hope and give them a way to move forward, you know.
What do you think are the most important things that people here tonight, what, hundreds of people at the Lenzic Theatre, can do?
Wow, there's a lot you can do. Look, like my country, your country suffered a catastrophic failure of leadership in this area. And I don't mean to be rude. And that's good and bad news, you know. It's tough, but it also opens the door for leadership at lower levels. And what Governor Schwarzenegger's done has exhibited extraordinary leadership at lower levels. But what we desperately need now is champions everywhere in society. You know, people that care about this, that are willing to make a statement, even if it's a simple one, like just changing the light globes in their home, you know, or maybe buying a more energy efficient car, you know. Or if they belong to a church group or a sporting group or any other organisation, just saying, well, let's have a look at the power bill. We're all part of this. Let's see how we can save some energy in this. And for their businesses, get an energy audit done. You know, try to address the issue of going carbon neutral in their business. But at every level, you know, to try to lead. And when it comes to the election, that's when you've got your great opportunity in this society. And don't just be a passive recipient of democracy. I would get out there and try to make a difference. And, you know, I always view elections as a bit like job interviews, you know, because these people are going to be representing us and doing important jobs for us for the next 4 years. So, you know, if someone came into a job interview to a company you ran and said, oh, I'll show you my CV after you give me the job, you know, like I'll make a promise and give you the details later, what would you say? You'd say, well, come back next week, or you'd say, thank you, you know, on your horse sort of thing. So, you know, I would just treat them as if they're coming for a job interview and say, well, you want to represent me for the next 4 years. What is your policy on this? Tell me exactly what you're going to do. How are you going to be held accountable for this? You know? So just treat democracy as the most important and precious gift we have, which it is, and try to make a difference.
Finally, you talked about Al Gore and the IPCC. I think very few people know what that group is, International Panel on Climate Change. What about its significance and what it has been doing?
Well, the International Panel on Climate Change is partly a UN organisation, which includes about 400 of the world's top climate scientists, plus a series of other people, government representatives and so forth. And what they've been doing is every 5 years for the last 20 years now, producing a sort of state of the atmosphere report, state of the global warming report. And their work has been thankless and difficult. They work on a consensus basis, so every sentence they write has to be agreed to by such enlightened people as the government representative of Saudi Arabia and even the United States and China. So it can be extremely tedious, and those people deserve the Buddy Order of Lenin, actually, as much as they do the Nobel Peace Prize. I mean, they're great heroes who've worked tirelessly to enlighten us as to what's happening.
And finally, you talk about making the power grid green.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
It just means stop burning fossil fuel to support our electricity and whatever. I mean, people, we live like cattle in a feedlot, you know. Most of us never think about where that power comes from or what the consequences of it are. Or we never think where this glass of water came from or what the consequences of using it are. And same with our food, you know, everything. One of the great... What sustainability is going to mean is liberating us from this great human feedlot and taking responsibility for our water and our food and our power, because that's how we interact with the world. You know, that's where our impact really is. So making the grid green is simply asking your energy provider, just say, I don't want to buy any of your filthy power anymore. Can you sell me some clean power? Can you sell me something from a wind farm? And if you can't, I'll go and... to my competitor. And if no one can do it, I'll buy some solar panels and run my system myself. You know, we're hardly totally captive to these people. We can make decisions and get out and do things. And of course, the great thing about the free market is they'll respond to those sort of pressures.
You've written specifically about New Mexico.
Yes. Yeah.
How important is New Mexico?
Well, it's... it is. I mean, it is important. It's... I think... You're very vulnerable here, you know. When you look at native populations in this area over the last 10,000 years, what we see is that when the world was warming 5,000 years ago, this area became depopulated, basically. You know, there was quite dense populations here, and then there was a period where there was no one, and then as the earth cooled again a bit, people came back in. And presumably those native populations dispersed because the resource base collapsed. There was no food here for them, no water here for them. And when I look at, when I come to this beautiful town and see how tenuous your water supply is, and us Australians value water, I can tell you we haven't got a lot of it. I do worry for places like this, because it's not as if you're going to be able to buy water from elsewhere. That's because these are global changes and the shifts will occur over vast regions. And you're also an affluent and wealthy and influential part of the world that can make a difference, you know. So I suppose if I could just say I will wish you the best and hope that you do make a difference. You must. We all have to. I'm sorry, I hope I'm not too depressing with the water situation, but we have to realise it's a serious one. Good, okay.
Well, on that note, I think... it is time to turn off the lights. Thank you very much for coming out. Thank you, Tim Flannery.
been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Haney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwidge Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcasts and the audio archives.